Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus. Know, O honored guest, that far from being the literary relics of a bygone age, the heroic tales that first emerged in ancient times in and around the Mediterranean Sea are alive and well today. Indeed, they are thriving in the modern world. The Olympic Games, instituted by the Hercules of Thebes to honor the 12 immortals, are now celebrated worldwide. Transpersonal psychologists have taught us how to detect and interact with the Greek gods that reside within our very own psyches. And game designers, using media undreamed of by our ancestors, still allow us to enter the past, present, and future exploits of heroic deities, demigods, heroes, and fabulous beasts. Now, my friend, release your hold of the current reality you find yourself in. Relax and enter the realm of timeless tales. Welcome to Mythic Adventure. Tonight, I'm very honored to bring you Tim Espy and Zach McAtee, and we will be exploring not only Greco-Roman mythical worlds, but worlds beyond that in other mythologies. Greetings and welcome, gentlemen. How are you?
Doing well, yourself?
Good evening. I'm well. How are you?
Doing well. I revisited Swords and Sandals, which I'll be talking about a little later. And I'm still pouring my way through Mythic Odysseys of Theros. So I'm permeated with mythology.
Very nice.
So how are things with you guys? I dropped by the Level 1 Games not too long ago, and everybody looked well, and although not as full as I'm used to it being before the pandemic, there were people there, and everybody seemed pretty happy.
Yeah, it's been good, all things considered. We've been crazy busy, which is nice. Yeah, like I said, we've just been super busy and trying to get some trades in and getting some new product in for the holidays and stuff for some last minute shopping.
Oh, fantastic. If you've gotten in a PlayStation 2, I'll be one of the last minute shoppers. And I'll pick that
right
up during the month. And Zach, how about you?
I'm still waiting for a nice one to come in for you.
Okay, I'll wait till a nice one comes in. Meanwhile, I'll organize things. I have a stack of DVDs and Blu-rays for you, too.
Okay, very good.
Zach, how are you?
I'm doing all right. Nothing too excited on this end. Mostly just, working, hanging out with Jamie. But I have a new RPG to talk about tonight and
awesome.
Board game I mentioned last time.
Okay, fantastic. How about this time we do it by category? And let's start with card games. Tim, anything new and exciting in the world of card games?
The new Magic set came out a couple weeks ago, maybe now.
Okay.
Called Commander Legends, where it's the first full set to be devoted to the format called Commander, where you have your commander. And it's a 100-card singleton deck, so it's single copies of every card except basic lands. So it offers a wide array of different, archetypes that you can play as. So this is the full set, or the first set, to be devoted to that format alone. So it's been selling really well because Commander has been exploding as of a couple of years ago, probably 2017 or so.
Uh-huh.
So it's been, Magic's been on the pulse of that and has been making products that have been really good, actually, for the Commander crew. And that's the format that I play, so it's nice when Magic releases some good product for it.
They had some for Theros, too. I seem to remember there were a couple of Commanders that came out with the Theros release.
Yeah. Yep. All the gods and the demigods can be set as your commander. So.
Okay. Okay, awesome. Zach, have you heard of any card games, or are you doing anything with card games?
There's a card game I've had my eye on called, I think it's just called Inuit the People. And
okay.
So I've always been a big fan of the Inuit culture and their myths, as Tim can tell you from some of the horror games I've run. But it's a, kind of, they call it a tableau building as opposed to a deck building card game. So the idea is instead of buying cards to then go into a deck that gets shuffled, you have a small board in front of you and you buy cards and assign them to spots on the board. And then they kind of fire off like an engine. So it circumvents the whole shuffling aspect and kind of cuts just to the meat of the subject. It looks pretty interesting, so I'm probably going to get that with some Christmas money towards the end of the year.
Oh, awesome. And is this a collectible card game also, or just preset cards?
Preset cards. It's self-contained.
It sounds exciting. Tim, is anything coming out other than the Magic Commander set for the holidays?
Nothing for cards. There's going to be stuff coming out at the end of January/February, which will be another set that you'll be really into. They just spoiled it a little bit. It's another Magic product, but it's called Call Time, and it's based on like Norse mythology. Finally,
oh, wow.
So the packs, they look like super like metal. Like that's the whole theme. Like, you know, like the genre of music metal. So I'm super into that because that's my favorite. And yeah, all the art looks really cool so far that they've released. But there hasn't been too much spoiled yet, so stay tuned for that. But
okay.
That's really all that's coming up. There's some Pokemon stuff coming up as well. But nothing before the holidays.
With me, with card games, basically, it's as I said last time, I decided to start collecting the not only Theros cards, but also all the Greek mythology cards. And I seem to remember from the dawn of the hobby that there were like Ogun, Minotaurs, Augur, mythical creatures. So as I rotated and find my great school magic cards, I'll be taking those out and basically creating a collection. We seem to have a bad audio connection.
Yeah.
There it was. It passed.
Oh.
We'll get some more things.
There we go. No.
No.
Is that better?
Hold on. That was it. It's on the 535 number.
535.
Yeah.
I could try to disconnect real quick.
Okay. Yeah, we'll try. Call right back.
Yeah.
Should I do the same?
Let's see if it's still there.
Okay.
Okay. And let me try. Okay, there's a little bit on your line also, so try the same, okay?
Okay, I'll hang up and call right back in.
Okay. Hey, Tim, how are you?
All right. That sounds a little better now.
Yeah, sounds a little better. And there was some of the static on Zach's line as well, so he's going to be calling back in too.
Okay. So I mentioned a game called Cyberpunk last time we talked,
yes.
Or probably a bunch of times that we talked. It finally released on Wednesday, so I started playing that on Wednesday and Thursday and over the weekend, and it's lived up to the expectations so far for me.
And how does the game play? Is it what type of game is it?
So it's a game by CD Projekt Red. They're the company that made The Witcher, actually. Based on the Netflix show, I believe, was based on it. So it's a future, takes place in 2077. So future, kind of, I wouldn't call it post-apocalyptic world, but it's very cyberpunk-esque, obviously, and it's a first-person shooter RPG where you have, I guess you call yourself a cyborg, and you can upgrade your eyes and your limbs and everything to do different, have different abilities and different weapons and stuff. So it's pretty expansive so far, and it's a big open world, and you can drive around and walk around. It's a fully populated city. I'm like 20 hours into it, and I just saw the title screen for it not too long ago. So I'm assuming this game is going to be pretty long.
And is this something that's like a standalone, or is this something that you can play with other people?
It's a single player only.
Okay. So this is something that somebody can physically buy, or is it something that they could stream, or both?
Yep. It's available on PlayStation 4, Xbox One, and then it'll be available for the new console soon. I'm playing it on my PC. So it runs really well on my PC. There's been some issues people have been reporting with some of the older consoles, but I haven't luckily run into too many problems with my PC.
I located for my PC Diablo 2. I found my copy of it, and it's so old that they won't accept the codes for it.
You would need to re-download it and rebuy it, basically.
Yeah, that's a shame, because I really loved that game and I used to play it. And I was able to play it for years. And I was in the middle of a new game, actually. I don't play very often, but I played it enough where it didn't matter. It's like learning how to drive or ride a bicycle. You know, it's like play Diablo 2. I was in the expansion, so it was only a few levels away from conquering the game again. Then my computer updated and it wouldn't let me load it. And that was the last time I played. And I think I mentioned I was looking that I might have like another copy of it. I found my original copy, and it just said that the code's no good.
Yeah, getting older games running on newer PCs is notoriously difficult.
Now, Zach, we crossed into the territory of video games and computer games. Any new ones that you're playing with or that you're revisiting?
I actually just finished beating one a couple days ago. I can't remember if we talked about it before. It's called Bloodstained: Ritual of the Night. So the idea is the creative team behind a lot of the big famous Castlevania games, which were put out by Konami. Konami had a big split with them because they decided to kind of move away from most of their game series and focus on, I think it was pachinko machines in Japan. Who knows why? But they cut pretty much all of their big famous franchises, which obviously didn't sit well with a lot of the fans. So Iga, the head of the creative team, started a Kickstarter probably, I want to say at this point, like 6-7 years ago to fund making their own game in that genre. They call it a Metroidvania. So it's a kind of a very involved platformer that takes place on one extremely large map, as opposed to having different worlds or levels. But the idea is you can only access certain parts of the world after you gain certain abilities by beating bosses and completing other things. So at first you can't double jump, but you'll come across areas that you can see, oh, as soon as I get the double jump, I can come back here and then go explore that way. And you just go through the whole area like that, and eventually, you know, you kind of fill in the map, and usually there's a collectible element. So in this one, you can collect souls from all the, or shards in this game, shards from all the monsters you kill, which are powers that you can then use. So I'm done with the story, but I need to go back and try and, like, get everything else.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a great return to form, because I loved those games growing up. I think the graphics jump was a bit weird, because all the ones I used to play were 2D pixel art, and then this went for a 3... It's 2D, but the graphics are 3D. Is that the best way to put it, Tim? I don't know if there's a better term for it.
Yeah. The level design is more 2D, where they're not sprites, but the sprites, if you will, are 3D.
Yeah. But so you still move on a flat plane, like like those kinds of platformers. It's not like a first-person view or a third-person camera. But the game was very good. The music was fantastic. The visuals were pretty cool. The enemy variety was nice. And it was fun seeing all the little Easter eggs that the development team put in towards the Castlevania series. Because they basically said, we're going to get as close as we can to it without touching it enough that they can try and cease and desist us. And so they have all these like small hidden references here and there. So one of the like optional bosses late game is a zombie version of one of the original Castlevania characters, Simon Belmont. You know, and they're like, oh yeah, it's the Revenant. You know, it's a dead guy. Don't worry about it. But you know, he's dressed exactly like him, and he uses all the same kinds of weapons and stuff. So it was really cool seeing all the little homages that they did to their earlier work.
That is great. I remember, I think I played the first two or three Castlevanias on Nintendo, I believe it came out originally for.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a lot of fun, and it continued. I didn't continue with it, but I know it continued through various platforms, and I saw last time I was in I think a Walmart or a Target or a Best Buy, I saw a DVD set, season one and season two. So I guess they made it into a series as well.
Yeah, the
it was the Netflix.
Blood of Hercules.
Go ahead.
The Blood of Hercules show that I sent you a message about a couple months ago. The same production team that did that made the Castlevania adaptation. So it's, I think, three seasons at the moment, and the fourth one should be coming out next year. It's very good.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the Blood of Zeus coming out on DVD or Blu-ray, because it looks very interesting. I was able to look on YouTube and find clips of the show, and it looks like something I'd really enjoy.
They have a really good knack for doing visually impressive fight scenes.
Any other video games coming out? Assassin's Creed is coming out with Ragnarok. Is that coming out soon?
Yeah, that one came out with the release of the new consoles.
Okay.
I have a buddy that has it, but I don't think he has jumped into it yet. So I haven't really heard too much about it. I'm curious to see what people's thoughts are.
Yeah, I haven't played the Odyssey one. I have the Odyssey. I have the book that went along with it. I have the strategy guide. I played it for like a few hours, but I haven't been able to spend as much time as I'd like with it. It's awesome, though. And I have a very vast library of books written by the characters, like Herodotus and Thucydides. And then you have the whole thing with Sparta, and that ties into 300 and the sequel. Yeah, so it's really fascinating how much supplemental material was there to help you further enjoy that world.
Right, and that was all stuff released by Ubisoft and everything, I assume?
Uh-huh. My eldest son... He has a PlayStation. He didn't get a chance to play very often either, but he got the Odyssey, and he played a lot more than I did. He finished the game, And he also told me that our island, Lemnos, you could visit it in the game. So he did. He went to the island of Lemnos and wandered around and had adventures there as well. So I guess if you're Greek, you have that going for you too. You can visit your homeland or a game version of it and do things there.
Yeah, that was one thing the Assassin's Creed team always, like, you know, prided themselves on was, you know, getting the world, like, almost as accurate as they could within, you know, within the confines of what they could make in a game. So, I know that I heard one time where, I don't know if it was, like, a college course or something, but they used the map of Venice, maybe, or something, because it was so close to what it, you know, was back then, or what they had, you know, the plans of what they had back then, and they, you know, could walk around in the city and study it like they were actually there.
I heard that there was some architecture destroyed somewhere in the world, and that they had done a version of it in the Assassin's Creed universe, and that helped them reconstruct some of the originals that were destroyed, so that's an awesome thing.
Right, yep.
In terms of role-playing games, I'll start off with Swords and Sandals. Swords and Sandals is a self-published RPG, and you can get it on Lulu. So Lulu is where you can basically become self-published and also sell your books. And the author, John M. Stater, has published a wide variety of games, including one that's Sword and Sorcery, and the focus on barbarians. So I got a copy of that one too, and I'll review it at a later time. Sword and Sandal gives you basically an opportunity to create the type of characters that you encounter in Sword and Sandal films, including gladiators and centurions and satyrs and Amazons and so forth. And it's a fairly easy to play system. It gives you templates for all the different types of characters, and then you can customize them through your dice rolls and your selection of skills and other types of attributes. And there is some randomization, and there is some ability to adjust after you've created characters. But anyway, it's a standard character creation system. Then they give you rules for resolving combat and other situations, advice on designing scenarios. They give you a sample scenario. And then they give you a very comprehensive bestiary. And I was amazed at the range of challenges that they gave you to confront in this game. It's very similar to 1PG, which I reviewed last time, Pax Gladius. And in fact, although the mechanics are not identical, you can easily take the best elements from both systems and create your own home rules variant of it. So I really enjoyed this. It was definitely worth less than $10 that they charged for it with shipping. And I'm looking forward to, after the pandemic, testing it out with actual people. Have you guys found any interesting RPGs?
Yeah, actually, I coincidentally enough, I just bought and started playing one, and my girlfriend tried it out too. It's called Artifact the RPG. So it's
cool.
A solo RPG, which... it's kind of more of a writing exercise, this one. There's not as much dice rolling and randomness. So they bill it as it's a fun solo RPG, but it's also a good way to develop story and world building for a campaign if you're setting up a world. So the basic idea is you are a magic item. You pick the item from a few templates they have. You can be a weapon, a shield, some part of armor. Maybe you're a magic tome or a wizard staff. So you find the correlating template, and then you come up with how you were created, who forged you, what they forged you out of, and you pick a few, I think it's three defining traits to start out. So over time, you can add and change these, but you start with three. They give you a suggested list for each type of item, but you can use whatever words you want, including ones that aren't in the game. The idea is then you follow the item through thousands and thousands of years.
Oh, wow.
The first thing you do is you pick who found you, and you describe how did they find you. You go to their page and you pick an archetype, like maybe it's the folk hero found me, or maybe a rogue found me, or a revolutionary, someone who, a bandit, something like that. You pick the corresponding page. They give you a couple questions pertaining to the archetype. So my first person was the folk hero. And one of the questions they asked was, how did you help this person defend a village? And then you just sit there and you come up with a story of how you assisted, maybe developing what the item can do, that kind of thing. And it ends with, how did they lose the item? So then they lost it somehow, and then you have to rest. And so there's a table, and the table says, okay, choose to rest for a day, a week, a month, and they have a soundtrack to go with the game. And so let's say I rested for a month. There's a sound file called a month, and then you sit there in the dark with your eyes closed and listen to the soundtrack to kind of get into the feel of having been just abandoned for X amount of time. And then you pick the next keeper and describe how they found you and answer their questions. The big thing with the game is that you play it over a long period of time. So there's three acts. During the first act, the longest point of time you can be lost for between people who find you is a month. But then when you get to act two, the longest you can be asleep goes up to like 100 years. And then when you get to act three, I think the minimum you can be asleep is 100 years, and it goes up to thousands by then. So the idea is you can really come up with ways that the world changes around you. And so I when I was describing it to my fiance, I told her, I was like, you can start this out in like a medieval-esque fantasy world, but then by the time you're, millennia ahead, maybe it's a sci-fi world at that point.
All right.
But it's really fun. Just again, it's more of a writing exercise than a game, but the bumper lines that they put to kind of give you like context and give you prompts and everything are really well done. I went into it the other night. I was like, oh, okay, they say the game takes 2 hours on average, so I'll sit here. I have like 2 or 3 hours by myself. I'll listen to some music, some ambient music, and go through this. And the game is played over six people who have you, two per act. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. So I'll bang out all six of them. I got so into it and wrote so much that I only did the creation of the item and the first keeper. and that took me like two and a half hours. So it's something that I'm looking forward to continuing and then reading it all once it's together. Because they have these really cool elements where you can, at the end of each time you spent with someone, you change your item in some way. So either you can add one of those traits I talked about before, or maybe it changes physically. So in my case, I made a mystic gem that when they found it initially was in like a leather bracer. But, I have ideas that at some point someone's going to take the gem out and do something else with it, put it in something else, And you're encouraged to keep a drawing of whatever the item currently looks like so that you can make changes on it as things happen. It's very fun.
I looked it up as you were talking. It's something that's available for free on the internet. Their source book is over 200 pages long. So this is a very involved game. And they have you could support them by buying them a cup of coffee for a dollar.
Yeah, it was definitely. I think I got it for $10 and. Already, it's more than worth it, and I've only played it. I've only done the first out of the six acts on one playthrough, and already it's worth it.
This sounds to me like something that would be great to integrate into a regular RPG. Like a change of pace. To basically have people tell the tales of the items that they have, that they currently found that are magical.
Yeah, and that's part of what's awesome about it is they give you a brief section on how maybe you might want to port it to existing systems and explain that you can use this to do that, to flesh out a backstory for maybe yourself, your item, or anything in between.
Because I could definitely see that, if they find some cool magical stuff, then do a session is they're figuring out what it does and then integrate what happens during the artifact session with the current campaign. And this would be something very interesting, something very different, and something very unique to add to the experience.
I'm glad I could bring it to your radar, because I, as soon as I started playing it, I immediately thought Hercules would have a great time with this. Because especially for people who are usually the DM and do a lot of world building, like this was very juicy.
Yeah, definitely I could see this. I found this system recently, but then I misplaced it, so I don't know if I'll say it that today, but my skim through, it was something that you could play by yourself, like solo, but it wasn't a pick your own path type of book. It happened organically, and it also involved storytelling. I was trying to integrate that as giving the players a way of continuing with their adventuring when we're not at a table, and then being able to count what happened to them and integrate it into the story. So this looks like something that would give another dimension also, so I plan on investigating this. Thank you for the link.
Oh, no problem. And one last thing about it, which I haven't gotten to try yet, is they do suggest that you can play this round robin. So you get a group of people together, and maybe over email or over physical written letters, you know, one person comes up with the creation story and then mail it off to the next person. And they do the time with the first keeper and then mail it off to the next person until the whole thing's done, and then you have a big collaborative story.
Oh, awesome. All right. Would you be part of something like that if I pull it together later on the year or next year?
Absolutely. I've already reached out to some friends back home to see if there's any interest to try it with them, because that got me really excited.
Okay, maybe I'll join yours then and experience it that way. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Tim, any role-playing games on your end?
No. Most of my RPG stuff comes either in the form of video games or whatever Zach, you know, teaches us or talks about. most of my knowledge is in the terms of video games when it comes to that stuff.
So you'll probably be artifacting it also. That might be a great way to adventure together, round robin solo artifact play.
Right. Yeah. I've been you know, stagnant with, you know, reading and expanding knowledge and stuff. I've kind of fallen off that. Because I haven't read that much stuff, whatever I had to in school and whatever stuff that struck me at the time. But I want to get back into it and do some, you know, creative writing or something just to expand knowledge. So this is I had no idea about this artifact thing, so it sounds cool.
Very cool. So good. I'm looking forward to an adventure developing from that. Zach, you said you also had a board game that you wanted to share?
Yeah. I mentioned last time a game called War Chest.
Yeah.
So War Chest is based on the idea that in ancient medieval times, the king was celebrating his son's birth. And all these people were coming forth and giving lavish gifts to the prince-to-be. And his general came up with a battered wooden box. And he said that this box is the same box that I taught you all of your strategy and tactics with when you were a child. I've saved it, and I've given it to your son. And so they've, quote-unquote, like, they act like it's real, and they're like, we've recreated the box here. And so, first off, the presentation for the game is phenomenal. It comes in what looks like a treasure chest that has a magnetic lid to open. So instead of just taking off a box top, you're opening it up like a treasure chest by swinging the top back on a hinge. And as soon as you open it, there's very lush, velvety draw bags that you're going to put your tokens into with either ravens or wolves emblazoned on them for the two different teams. And then underneath of that, you find a plastic tray of very nicely decored and weighted poker chips. So I say poker chips, they're a bit thicker, but in gaming terms, that's what we usually refer to them as. Tim knows exactly what I'm talking about, because anytime we see a game with those components, we immediately lose our shit because they're so fun to play with. They have a nice weight to them. They always look nice. And it's nice to have that tactile connection to a game where you actually want to be touching the components.
Satisfying is the word.
It's very satisfying. So it's major points aesthetically. And gameplay-wise, I think this is probably in my top 10 favorite board games. I originally bought it because it is able to be played two-player. And so obviously during the pandemic, I've been in lockdown and everything, and me and my fiance have been playing a lot of two-player games. So that was what piqued my interest in it.
That
is
good.
It does support up to four players. So it's either two, or you break into two teams of two, and you play an alternating, so it would be a raven, a wolf, a raven, a wolf. The idea is each one of the little poker chips has a different icon on it. It might be a raven or a horse on a blue background, a horse on a brown background. Maybe this one is a Celtic knot. Each one of those symbols corresponds to a card that tells you the name of that piece, how it moves, if it has special movements, and if it has any special ways to attack. Each player is dealt four if you're playing two-player, or three if you're playing with four people, and they are the only people with copies of those types of warrior. So if I were playing with my fiance Jamie, I might have the scout, the knight, the pikeman, and a mercenary, and she can't have those. She has four different ones. She might have light cavalry, a bowman, a berserker, a warrior priest, something along those lines, and we lay the cards out face up so you can always see what your opponent can do. You take two of each of the chips and put them into your draw bag to start the game out. And every turn you draw three coins and then take turns playing them one at a time. With your coins, you can do a couple things. The first and most important is you can deploy them to the map. You start with two control points or command points, as they call them, on the board. And the idea is the first person to claim six of them wins. So on a command point that you control, you're able to summon a token from your hand. So if I wanted to play the scout, I would just put him on a command token that I control that didn't currently have anyone on it. You can do other things with them. If I draw a second scout, so I drew two scouts out on my turn, I could play the scout with one and then discard the other one face up to either make that unit move, attack, use a special ability if it has one, or if it's on an open command point, I can then claim it and put my marker on it to say that it's mine. So it gets to this interesting balance of how many coins of each type you have in your bag. You can buy new ones from the supply and put them in, but each one has a hard limit. So depending on how powerful the piece is, they range from four to six of each one. So for instance, the knight, which is a particularly powerful piece because he's very, very defensive and hard to kill, there's only, four pieces of the knight in the whole game. If one of them ever dies, it's removed from the game entirely, which means not only are you losing a piece on the board, that never goes back into your draw bag, which means that now there's only three knight coins. So if you have another one on the board later, there's only two coins you can draw from your bag to let him do anything. So it gets very down to the wire, because if I want to go all in like that, and let's say I buy every knight piece, I'm going to see the knight come up a lot more often in my draw bag. I'll activate him more across my turns. But I'm also risking him dying more, and once those extra coins are gone, if I have him on the board and nothing left in my draw bag, I can't do anything with that piece. It's now just dead weight on the board. So you take turns killing each other, maiming each other, and running across the board trying to claim the control points until one of you has taken all six. We played it with, I think at this point we've tried every single different piece. We haven't done every combination because there's, I want to say, probably 20 or 22 different pieces. There was a base game and an expansion which I bought, which added an extra four of them. Which, that again, back to the production quality, the expansion is designed to look like a novel, like an old-fashioned history tome that you put on your shelf, and it opens up magnetically the same way that the treasure chest does. So again, very, very top-notch production quality. But it's very fun. There's a lot of replayability. We've tried it with two and four. I do prefer it with two just because the game goes a lot quicker and you each get an extra piece, so you have that extra bit of variety. But if you do play with four players, each player has three units that only they have. My only complaint with that is there's no way to like put a token or anything on your piece to indicate who it belongs to. So when you're playing with four people, the board gets very cluttered, and it might be hard to remember without looking at their cards who everyone owns on the board. So I definitely think two-player is better than four, but both are fun, and I played four-player with Tim one time, and we had a really good time with it.
Oh, wow. You're very good at finding unique type of experiences in gaming.
Thank you. And so I try and keep my ears open for anything that sounds a bit different. I try to have as much variety on my shelf as I can.
Tim, how about you? Any board games or board type games?
Yeah, actually, I just got a notification. So I kickstarted a board game a couple months ago, probably, that is based off, maybe obviously for me, based off of The Thing, the movie. So I just got a notification for that saying that, you know, everything is moving forward well, and I ended up just getting nearly all of the additional add-ons that they got. So I got a nice playmat and the expansion and the nicer upgraded tokens and everything. So I paid for all that and should be shipping sometime next year. I'm not sure when exactly. The company is based out of Italy, I believe. So they've been working away on it for the past couple of months. So hopefully that comes, you know, relatively early in 2021, and I can have a review up for that.
Wow. Do you guys fund game developers a lot? Or was this something you did because of the content and its interest to you?
I've backed a few things on Kickstarter. I did this one because it was something that interests me. Zach is the Kickstarter guy.
Okay.
Yeah. My New Year's resolution last year was to try and not kickstart as much stuff, and it didn't really work out.
How does that work exactly? Because I've supported some stuff on Kickstarter and others I didn't, primarily because it was expensive.
Yeah, a lot of...
For what they were sending, it was very expensive in terms of even things like shipping. The shipping was like two or three times what I would normally pay for shipping. So so how would one get involved in supporting the work of creative people who might be doing something that you'd like to see?
Well, if they're on Kickstarter, you know, that's a great start right there. And then Kickstarter itself usually is a good way for the different companies and small groups that that make these things to get a following and start a community. They have a separate tab for just conversation about the game, and then usually the better companies at it, the more involved ones, will do things like, oh, okay, every week we're going to see who talked about the game the most on our Facebook page or something, or whoever recommended the game the most. If you know, or if you do that, we enter your name into a drawing. And then every week we'll draw somebody, and you win. Maybe you get to design a card, or you get an extra component for free, that kind of thing. So they do that to try and keep people involved, and it really works. People love being a part of something, especially if they go as far as maybe listing the backers and stuff in the instruction manual or on the box or something like that. Like, that really means a lot to everyone. So that draws a lot of people in to support them. Besides that, I don't really, like, there's a few things like DriveThruRPG is a good website to find a lot of independently published RPG modules and splat books. So I believe you can get that Artifact game that I mentioned earlier through there, or through the link I sent you. But, you know, that's a good website to find a lot of independent produced stuff if you're looking for RPGs. Other than those two sites, I don't really know too much about it. Those are pretty much the only two that I interact with as far as that kind of support.
Wow. So do you search like with keywords or with key concepts to see what's going on?
Yeah, every once in a while, usually like every month, every other month, I'll go on the Kickstarter website, and I usually look for board games, mostly board games or dice, stuff like that. And because I spend so much time and money on Kickstarter, I frequently get ads for board games on Facebook and Instagram, because they know that I support so many. I'll get constant ads about, oh, this game is coming out on Kickstarter. Why don't you sign up for the, you know, or like release notification when it comes out? And so I find a lot of them through that. So for once, it's targeted ads are actually working, I guess. It's for once, it's a good thing.
Okay, I have to start checking that out. I know that for a while, a company called Modiphius was publishing Conan Thing, and I would wait until they were available on Amazon and eBay, and just check to see where it was cheaper, and I'd pick up a copy. And for quite a while now, I'd say for nearly a year, they haven't been releasing physical copies. They've been releasing just PDFs. So I haven't really been following what they're doing, and they seem to have picked up some other fantasy properties like the Elder Scrolls, and now they're publishing books in that series. And how about just basically exclusive content? Sometimes I noticed that when people were talking about Kickstarter or some of the other Indiegogo or GoFundMe, there's like things that you could only get if you approach them through there, and if you're part of that, that they're not commercially available afterwards.
Yeah, a lot of the stuff, a lot of the upgrade stuff is Kickstarter backer only. I think the upgraded tokens that I got for the Thing game were Kickstarter backer only. Like, once it ends, then you can't get them anymore. They wouldn't be available at the retail setting. So there's definitely, you know, a big incentive of getting in early to help kickstart it so that you do get those exclusive, you know, special things.
And those things are hard
and to
get after,
time.
Too.
A lot of the times, too, what they'll do is they'll have it set up so that there's a what they call an early bird special or an early bird award. So the idea is if you back during the first 24 hours, you will get a component that other backers won't get. And so that's why a lot of the times you'll see ads for games that haven't even released on Kickstarter yet, and they'll ask you if you want to be notified when the game comes out so that if they have those early bird specials, you can jump on it as soon as it releases. And there have been times that where I've sat there counting down, okay, it's going to go off at 10 a.m. tomorrow morning, and I want to get in there early so I can get the reduced price or get the extra item, that kind of thing.
Yeah, a lot of the time the early bird ones are, you know, a certain percentage off as well, you know, 10, 15, 20% off.
So it's something worth doing, but it could become something that's very addicting in terms of time and resources as well. Hey, you guys are very creative, and we've discussed in the past some creative ideas. Did you ever think of doing something and putting it on Kickstarter?
It's funny that you say that. I wasn't going to put Zach on the spot. I figured we'll wait a little bit, but
okay.
It's up to Zach.
Yeah. I'll talk about it now. So I've had an idea for a board game, and it popped up in my head probably about 2 or 3 months ago, and I just kind of let it sit there. I text myself the rough outline so I wouldn't forget it, and I just didn't really like focus on it, didn't pay it much mind. But every once in a while when I was busy, like when I was out walking or something, or doing something, listening to music, or zoning out, I would just sit there and kind of tinker away with it in my head. And 2 weeks ago, I sat down, and over the course of a couple hours, I wrote up the first draft of the rules and all the mechanics and stuff like that. And Tim, Jamie, and I tried it out probably about a week ago at this point. And Tim, what did you think of it? Because that's coming better from your perspective, since I'm kind of obviously biased.
Right. So as like revision, 0.0, like sitting down to play it, you could already tell that, it was a game. Like the concept was there. It was fleshed out enough where the core concepts were there. And as we were playing, we came up with a few, little tweaks and everything when everything was in play that needed to be adjusted. So now, it's revision, 0.1, if you will. And now it's sitting down again and changing up the teams a little bit and retrying it and trying it again. But like I said, as a concept, it's already, it's already super close already almost. It's already been good.
So do you have to contact the artists, and do you have to contact companies to make the pieces and all that, and printers to print things up, or to format things on PDFs? That's up to the person setting up the Kickstarter.
Yeah, typically what people go to the Kickstarter for is for the money to pay for those services. So usually what they'll do is they'll go through the playtesting, which is the stage we're in now, is we're in playtesting and development. So once they get to a certain point in that where they feel they're comfortable and there won't be many more changes or the changes will be minor, then they start shopping around for artists, for different companies to handle the printing and the processing, the shipping, making the box components, that kind of thing. Once you have started getting quotes and everything, typically what you do is you make one or two small physical copies to then take to, a lot of times now they're called unpubs. It's a small gaming event for unpublished games, for people who are in game development but haven't gotten the game published, but have it to the point where it's play testable. So they do this to drum up interest in the game, as well as get more feedback from people who they don't normally see every week. And, I'm sure Tim will give great feedback, but again, Tim's a very close friend. So Tim will probably not say something that someone who doesn't know me from Adam would say. They'd be like, well, fuck you, I think this sucks. So the idea is to get other opinions and to drum up interest before moving into a circuit of either kickstarting, Indiegogo, something similar like that. Nick and Diane have done that for several of their games. I helped them out with, I think it was Looting Atlantis, was the one that I went to an unpub with them with to help run that. And so Nick and I went to Connecticut, actually. It was a hefty drive. We went to Connecticut and we got to the game store. It was a very nice, large game store, and there was probably about six or seven different small companies hosting different games, and we just sat there and ran the game over and over again. Sometimes if we didn't have enough people, I would play. Other times I would run a second game for another group of people, and we just spent probably 7 to 8 hours there, like a solid work day, getting feedback from people. We had little cards for them to fill out of what they liked, what they didn't like, what their favorite mechanic was, how they felt about the art, how they felt about this. And once you move through that, then you move on to trying to get the funding. Because at this point now, the game's in the final stages. You've gotten a lot of feedback to hopefully fine-tune it to the purpose that you want. You've gotten your quotes for how much stuff's going to cost, and now the problem is just getting the money to pay it off. So that's where you usually enter kickstarting to drum up the funds rather than put it all out yourself, because, as we mentioned before, people like to be a part of it. So it helps you because you're crowdfunding the money, so it's less out of your pocket. But then also people can say, see this game on my shelf? I helped make this game become real. I helped make this game. That's why I got very excited last year when I helped edit the Alien RPG that came out. And in the book, they have a thank you page. And I remember when I first got it, I opened it up and I took a picture of it and like circled my name and sent it to like everybody I knew, because I was just so excited to see my name in the book.
Well, I'm thinking, I'm proud of you. That is awesome. I'm thinking we can, if you're willing to share your adventures or what you could share, we could follow them every month on the show. And also, if you decide to do Artifact or some other game, that's something, too, we can follow on the show. I can contact the person who designed Artifact, Jack Harrison, and see if we can interview him, and then we can just basically do the round robin on the show and share what we've written rather than just sending it around by email. So we could do that as well. I like both of those ideas. How do you guys feel about that?
Yeah, that would be super
I would totally
fun.
Be down. I think that's a really good idea, too, to reach out to him. As a small creator like that, I'm sure that that would be fantastic.
So I will do that between now and next time. I'll contact him. I'll let him know that we talked about his show and send him a link and basically invite him to share his journey. I have linked to a free copy that I'll share. I've linked, when I typed in the artifact, the RPG, it sent me like a free copy initially. I already posted a link to the $10 copy so that people can order it. And we'll take it from there. And then we'll set aside some time to discuss both of your adventure with your new game.
That sounds fantastic.
Awesome. And I just looked at the clock with 3 minutes left. Would you guys like to share your contact information?
Sure. I can go first.
Okay.
The best way to get in contact with us at Level 1 Games is either through Facebook or Instagram. If you just type in Level 1 Games, it comes right up. You can send us a message if you have any questions. Whenever we get new stuff, new product, it always gets posted on those social media sites. And if you see anything you like, give us a call. We can answer your questions. More than happy to help you out.
Thank you very much. And Zach?
As always, you can reach out to me at Mr. Munin, MrMunnin, at gmail.com, or by searching me up on Facebook and sending me a message there.
Thanks to both of you. Despite the sound problems, I enjoyed this conversation immensely. And I wish you both a happy holiday and a wondrous new year. And I hope to see you very soon.
Yes,
and
have a
you.
Safe and happy holiday.
Thank you. And thanks to everybody who's joined us, whether you're listening live as we speak or you'll be checking us out later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. And to all of our listeners also, very happy and healthy holidays and a wondrous new year. We're going to close with Virginia Ackley's If You Can Dream, as we often do, because as Zach and Tim mentioned, our thinking of something and then making it real is our most divine power. And there's nothing as satisfying as creating. So I'm really honored that we're going to be sharing the creation process here in the days to come. Take care, everybody. And again, thanks again.
If you can dream, if you can fly, then your heart can touch the sky, but only if you can dream. If love is true and love is real, pain and sorrow soon will heal, but only if you can dream. Dream till you wake, dream till you feel, dream till you know it, dream till it's real. If you can dream, then you can be found by love and yet be free, but only